Welcome to Mustard Aonaise. I am Matt.
And I am Richard.
We discuss things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest, and then we remember to talk about.
Absolutely.
Don't always remember to talk about things because we're very unorganized individuals. But we talk about movies, TV, DVD, video games, stuff like that. I have seen no new movies this week.
I saw one, sort of new.
What did you see?
Mongol.
Oh, yeah, that looked really interesting.
Yeah, it was weird. It was actually playing up at the Alderwood 7-plex.
No kidding.
Which stunned me. And when you go in there, first of all, I don't know when they had decided to put it up there, but the sign on the theater mark or the theater outside the door of the actual screening said "The Incredible Hulk," and so did the little reader board. They didn't bother to even change it. But when we went in there, it was a pretty full house. We saw it on Friday afternoon, and there was a lot of people there. It wasn't even the evening showing. It was interesting.
Really?
At least half the people in there were, the audience was clearly Chinese, which they were probably interested in it maybe because of the subject matter, I guess, but it was still a pretty good movie. It wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good and very interesting. I had no idea about a lot of the history of Genghis Khan. And
well, how much of it was fictionalized?
Well, afterwards I went back and looked online, like at Wikipedia and stuff, and first off, there isn't that much known about, this is like the first of a proposed trilogy about Genghis Khan, so this is just his life from being born up to when he first became, a leader, and a lot of that there is very little known, so you have to take whatever it is with a grain of salt, but looking on Wikipedia, it was clear a lot of it was pretty true to his story, although some of it was they took stuff out. Like they wanted to really emphasize his real connection to his wife and his love. And then you read on Wikipedia and you realize, well, he had like many wives, and they don't really talk about that because there's always a primary wife, which is this one, you know. I watched this really fascinating History Channel show last year about it, where they did a genetic sampling of people of Mongolia and the region and other stuff, and they, through a variety of means, determined that almost certainly like 10% of all Mongols are directly related to Genghis Khan. And that's because what he did was he basically unified this whole area where it used to be all these little warring clans. And then he had tons of kids. And because of a variety of reasons, they're going to prosper because they're related to him. So they figured this out on this show. So in this movie, you sort of imply, oh, it's just him and his wife, and in reality, it's him and a lot of kids. So, but anyway, it was exciting, it was interesting. It was nominated for Best Foreign Language Picture last year, and it was, I saw the one that won, which was this German-Austrian movie called The Counterfeiters, which was not that great. This was actually way better. But the Academy loves to nominate Holocaust movies and give them the award. But this was actually better. Wasn't that great, but it was still pretty good. I liked it.
I find it interesting that the doors and the marquee were wrong. I'm always paranoid about walking into the wrong theater.
Yeah.
So I'm always checking that. And honestly, I haven't walked into a mismarked theater. I can't remember the last time I did it.
I got the impression that, that they still had the, I mean, I could understand the poster, you know, that they put on the door.
Right.
That poster, you know, sometimes that, I mean, that takes a little bit of physical work to change, but the marquee, the little reader board that's outside of the screen, that's changed somewhere else. That should be easy enough to change, but they didn't bother to do it, but everybody still went to it and figured it out. You know, it was, it was mystifying. That theater, they, has always been just a dump, and they remodeled it a couple years ago, made it much better, but it's still.
I wouldn't have called it a dump.
Oh man, that theater was great when it opened, but before they remodeled it, you know, the THX screens, remember when they used to be THX screens? They were so beat up, they'd have like yellow tape across like 10% of the seats because they were so broken. And then now that they've remodeled it, it's nice, but you go in there and they definitely don't have enough staff and, you know, it's just a weird theater. But the screens are all nice because they're all those stadium seating for once. So, and I haven't really noticed any problems with projection or anything anymore. They seem to figure that all out. But anyway, so Mongol, and it was Mongol was a Kazakhstan movie. A lot of it was financed and funded in Kazakhstan, which is
wow.
With oil money, which is interesting. It's really a Russian movie, I think, and it's like Russian, Chinese, and others. But my understanding is the Kazakhstan really financed it, putting lie to the notion that that Borat puts out about Kazakhstan. So anyway, it was pretty interesting, and it made me get excited that maybe it'll be the first part of a trilogy. That said, I was looking at the Box Office Mojo numbers, and The Thing was a very expensive movie, all things considered. It was like $20 million, and worldwide it's only made like $18 million, so I don't know that they're going to actually make, you know, version 2 and 3, but just for pure historical reasons, it would be interesting, because, you know, Genghis Khan, it really made me look back in Wikipedia, and you realize that this guy was a more successful, you know, sort of empire maker than Alexander the Great, than anybody else. This guy had, I mean, by the time he was done, he controlled all of Asia, China, all Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary. He controlled all of it. I mean, it's just amazing amount of territory this guy was able to overcome, and I really knew nothing about him at all. So, and anyway, interesting movie.
Yeah, and it did have a marketing budget because I've seen commercials for it.
Really? Well, maybe yes. That's why, because when it first came out, they had it for a week at the Egyptian Theater or something, and my uncle was interested in seeing it, but he hates going down to like Seattle or the U District, and when we saw it down here, I was just surprised. So maybe it'll pull out some money.
Well, that'd be cool.
Yep.
We have watched some more DVDs this week. We saw Collateral last weekend.
Yep.
Man, that is just a cool movie.
Yeah, very well
done. There's a lot of things about that really work well. I had completely, you know, sort of forgotten the Tom Cruise role, especially of him as the bad guy.
Yeah.
And in looking at this, this may be my favorite Tom Cruise role that he's ever done.
Yeah, he's great in that movie.
He really is. It really makes you forget all the extraneous BS associated with him and Scientology and Katie Holmes and all that.
The irony is he's actually had a lot of good movies in recent years. Mission Impossible 3 was a great movie. War of the Worlds is a pretty good movie. This Collateral is a terrific movie. And you just kind of forget how his personal life so subsumes your thoughts about the guy that you forget that more often than not, he really delivers, and increasingly so as he gets older.
Yeah, well, I was really, you know, watching this movie again. I've seen it, you know, three or four times before. Really impressed. It was such a cool movie, and there were so many subtle beats to it. I mean, Michael Mann is just a stud. He's taken the Cops and Robbers movie and, you know, tried so many different, you know, approaches to it, and it just, he's such a stud.
Yeah.
Do you know what his next Cops and Robbers movie is?
Yeah, he's doing a historical movie that he's filming right now with Johnny Depp about what's his name? The gangster in the 30s. God, what is his name? The one who was shot and his girlfriend was the lady in red or whatever. What the heck is his name? Anyway, he's filming another historical gangster movie in Chicago.
Interesting.
And there's been some pictures of Johnny Depp floating around the internet where he's all dressed up as the guy.
The other thing with Michael Mann movies, especially when you see a few in a row, You're reminded that he has this this cadre, this group of actors that he really likes to work with, and he puts them in everything, and it's great. I like the actors he uses, but you know, there's kind of the one overweight black guy with a really interesting face that's kind of jowly. One of the girls with the curly hair he keeps using, and I won't go on and on, but it's funny, especially looking at he used them in Robbery Homicide Division, the show that we both like. And, you know, but in everything, Miami Vice and this, and it makes you want to go back and watch Heat and see, and it's like, oh, I can't remember how he used him in Heat. I want to go watch that again. And,
Heat's so awesome. The movie is, it's called Public Enemies, starring Christian Bale and Johnny Depp.
Bale's been busy lately because he's also supposed to be shooting that Nottingham thing for Ridley Scott.
Yep.
And Terminator, whatever the next Terminator is.
I know, which they're saying to strike or no strike, they're plowing ahead, and it's about John Dillinger. This is not good. Lily Sobieski is in it. That's never that never portends a good movie. But it's got a lot of stars. It's got Marion Cotillard, it's got Billy Crudup, Giovanni Ribisi, Lily Taylor. Stephen Dorff, haven't heard from him in a while. Rory Cochrane from Dazed and Confused.
Giovanni Ribisi gets a lifetime pass for me because he's been on My Name is Earl.
Did I lose you?
No, I'm here. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Apparently not. Dude. Oh. Okay.
You know, I'm beginning to think it's this ridiculous headphones that I have. I might replace them. Anyway, you were mentioning about Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah, I was saying he gets a lifetime pass for me for being on My Name is Earl.
Oh, you know, I actually stopped watching that after a while. I do like the guy.
Yeah, he played one of their redneck crime buddies. And there's been a couple of scenes where he's, like, just in his underwear. And it's I don't know, he strikes me as pretty fearless.
Yeah, he's a cool dude.
Anyway, looking forward to that. I'll see that in the theater. Love Michael Mann. And the other thing we just watched again last night was Knocked Up.
Wow, according to this, its release date is July 1st, 2009. So it's a while in. So did you watch the extended unrated version? Was there anything new in that?
I guess. I mean, I don't think it made you choose, because usually when they do the unrated versions, it's just you don't have to choose anything in the menu, right?
Yeah, no. Usually they just throw new stuff in. Sorry. In fact, I think I have that version. Yeah.
Well,
in fact,
no, that's yours is the one I'm borrowing.
Okay. You know what's funny about that? The more I watch that, the more I keep hearing stories about what's her name in the actress or
Katherine Heigl.
Katherine Heigl. God, she starts to drive me nuts. When she was promoting this movie, Knocked Up, she, like, bad-mouthed it. She started, like, before it was coming out, quietly saying, well, some of the humor I don't really agree with and stuff like this. And she started bad-mouthing it. And then did you see the what she pulled 2 weeks ago before the Emmy ballots were out? She basically said, I don't want to be on the Emmy, or I'm withdrawing my name because the quality of writing just wasn't up to par or whatever. What a horrible, horrible person, man. I mean, how does she think she's going to keep getting jobs in Hollywood if she badmouths the behind-the-scenes people?
I don't know that I would call her a horrible person, but that one incident was definitely...
Damn, if I was a writer, I would call her the most horrible person on the planet. What an awful thing to say, man. You know? When it's clear she's having issues with the show, so she just decides, well, I'm going to throw them under the bus. She doesn't want to be on the show. She's been trying to get out of her contract forever. She doesn't seem to realize that there's a model for doing that, and that's the George Clooney method. You don't ask for any additional money. You just work out your contract and just move on, and everybody thinks you're cool. You don't sit here and bitch about it and throw people under the bus like she's doing.
Well, I'll give her another incident before I call her a horrible person. But
well, there was another one before that, too. I can't remember what it was, but anyway.
I honestly didn't notice anything different in terms of it being the unrated extended edition.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I only saw it the once in the theater and really enjoyed it, but I could not pick out a single additional line or scene in it.
I mean, dude, I've managed to lose you again. I don't know if you can hear me. I'm going to hang up and call you back. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
Boy, something's coming in and out. I just couldn't hear you for some reason. Anyway, yeah, I think if I remember right, you listen to the commentary track and they talk about what's in or out or whatever.
I'm probably not going to have the time to listen to the commentary for that.
Yeah.
I don't think it was that.
It was okay. It wasn't anything great. Like 40-Year-Old Virgin was like a great commentary track because a lot of funny guys were just sitting there riffing on the movie, and this was not quite that, but it was okay.
I just saw a commercial for Mummy: Curse of the Dragon's Tomb or whatever the third Mummy is.
Yep.
And you just, I don't think anyone is clamoring to see a third Mummy film.
No. Well, that said, they might not be clamoring, but just what would be your guess on how much each of those previous ones made worldwide?
Oh, I'm sure it was a lot.
Well, what do you think?
I don't know. I'm not going to guess.
Boy, that sounds like pained. Well, the first, let's see, The Mummy Returns made $450 million worldwide. So, and then the first one made $420 million. So if I was a movie producer, I'd be going, yeah, well, I'm clamoring to make another one because clearly they make a lot of money, even though they're goofy, dumb movies. But yeah, looking at that, you can see what they're doing. They're going, oh, can we do another stupid mummy thing? And then they realize, well, I got it. Let's go to China. We can have Jet Li and get a more international crowd or whatever. So I guess that's what they're doing. But it looks just like more of the same. I didn't like either of the first ones. I thought they were dumb and unenjoyable.
I agree. There was one clever line in the first one, and that was about it. Or one line that actually made me and John laugh when we saw it. But that was it. I think that's it for as I crane my neck to look at the DVD rack. Yeah, so I've only watched those two in the past week. Oh, and we watched one of the HD channels had American President.
Oh, that's a great movie.
So we watched that. Yeah, it is. But there were, for some reason, I was more critical of it this time. I noticed there were ticks, either performance ticks or writing ticks that I didn't.
You certainly
really rang.
See the Aaron Sorkin through the. Now that you
no,
seen
not
it,
that not
what's that
not that because I think this was this came American President was after A Few Good Men, right?
Yes.
It wasn't, I mean, there were some Aaron Sorkin-isms, and if you watch enough Aaron Sorkin, you certainly pick up on some of his themes and things he likes to do, but it was more kind of weird I don't know if it was Rob Reiner director choices, but there were just a few beats that rang false. And part of it's that, I think, in this case, when he took West Wing and basically made a series out of that movie,
yep.
You're used to the West Wing, and you're used to the fact that they had, you know, 7 years to explore the politics and the characters pretty well.
Yeah.
And so, or, you know, even by the third, you know, and everyone agrees sort of the first 3 years were the best, but you're sort of used to them having worked it out. And in this movie, a lot of that hadn't been worked out. It wasn't as polished. And
yeah.
So I think it kind of suffers from watching it after The West Wing. You know, that said, it was still pretty good and enjoyable and, I don't know. It's one of those you really get irritated that he's got this one line towards the end where Michael Douglas's president character is talking about the ACLU and, you know, how come the right wing Richard Dreyfuss character is on him for being, you know, a card carrying ACLU member. And he's saying, no, the question here is, why aren't you a member? This is an organization. Their whole goal is to protect the Bill of Rights. How can you, you know, proclaim to love America and yet not want to protect the Bill of Rights? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That line just really, to me, rings true. And it's like, how come actual politicians aren't using that line? Because
yeah.
Real Republicans love to use, you know, it's a card-carrying ACLU member, and apparently that's just the worst thing you could possibly be, along with maybe gay. And, you know, why, you know, it's, you hear that line, you're like, oh my God, that rings true. Why isn't anyone hitting back with that in real life?
Anyway. Well, the ACLU will tell you quietly that stuff like that has been very helpful for their own fundraising, at least in a sense, and membership roles, because a lot of people are offended by that, and they love to, you know, I noticed after that, like a lot of the ACLU and others, they started, you know, there was no card that you got necessarily, but after that, this stuff became prominent in like the early 90s. Suddenly people were, suddenly they would make sure that when they got a membership, they had a card that you could show, because people wanted to say, I'm a card-carrying member. Unfortunately, it was like a small population, but I remember distinctly, Ruby, calm down. I remember distinctly when I got one of my myriad, solicitations from different groups, and I got mine from the ACLU, and it came with a pre-done card. I made sure to pull that thing out and show people, hey, I'm a card carrying member, just because you like to say that. But no, I agree. It's amazing how it's become this shorthand for this awfulness. And it's like, no, this is a pretty good organization that is uniquely American and uniquely in our best interest.
Was your card right next to your Herbert Kornfeld ID?
Herbert Kornfeld. Oh, I forgot about that. Well, before that, I had, before the Herbert Kornfeld, I had, Leon Spinks. And before Leon Spinks, I had, Elvis Presley. But Herbert Kornfeld was the best. I'm getting one of those, by the way. I decided to sign up for one of those new enhanced driver's license IDs. I've decided to sell my soul to Big Brother. Have you heard about those?
Okay. Why? Why'd you do that?
Well, because if you go across the Canadian border, it becomes easier. If you're close, they just scan it and it has more information, so you don't need a passport, and other stuff. So, you know, so I went ahead and got the dang thing. Actually, I went ahead and signed up, but to get it, you have to make an appointment at the driver's license place. And the earliest appointment I could get was August 28th. So it's like 2 months out. Apparently people are lining up to give away their freedoms and civil liberties like me.
Well, that's because you need to have access to the pot fields of British Columbia. So.
Well, my mom lives up there, so just kind of want to visit her.
And her pot fields.
And her pot fields. Yeah, her pot fields in the 17th floor of her condo. Although, I think I told you before, but she lives on the 17th floor of this really nice condominium thing. I mean, these are premium things. And 2 years ago or a year ago, somebody discovered there was a meth lab in like one of the condos, like four floors below, and it like started some fire, and they had this and somebody turned on the sprinkler system, and it like flooded out all the apartments on that floor and everything. But there was like a meth lab, and they had to spend like several hundred thousand dollars cleaning this thing up and stuff. This is like condos worth like $700,000, and somebody's running a meth lab in one of them.
Nice.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, so let's see. I was kind of flipping through Dark Horizons, and I saw that David Fincher is bought the option, and I guess is producing a CG animated film based on a comic book character called the Goon.
Really?
Which I thought, that's not something I would have imagined David Fincher would have gotten involved in. It doesn't sound like he's going to direct it, but... I've never read that comic, so I have nothing to add other than I thought it was weird, because David Fincher is one of those guys, along with Paul Thomas Anderson, that you and I just go ape about.
Absolutely.
What was the other one? Is it a wrestling film or a boxing film that one of them is working on?
Fincher? Oh, Paul, I don't know anything Paul Thomas Anderson. It'd have to be Fincher, because Paul Thomas Anderson, I mean, there's nothing coming out about him near as I can tell.
Let me punch in Fincher Boxing to see what comes up. I'm right there. No? All right. Well, I guess IMDb is probably the better way to go. Whoops. Oh, nothing like listening to a guy look something up on the internet. While I'm doing that, what else did I see that was interesting? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. oh, this, you see that comment that Eddie Murphy said he might retire, and then he kind of backed it off. And then he was sort of saying, oh, the script for Beverly Hills Cop 4 isn't ready yet.
Well, yeah, he's not actually attached at this point. They're talking about
not?
This.
I didn't know that.
No, that's the funny thing. And then I think it's probably because, he's sort of seeing the interest in, what's the new movie? Pluto Nash 2?
Meet Dave.
Yeah, no, I was joking.
Okay.
Pluto Nash, notorious for costing $140 million and making about $2 million in the box office. So this movie here, who knows what it is, but it just, I think the epitome of a bad Eddie Murphy film is that babysitter movie he did?
Daddy's Daycare.
That's one everybody'd point to as him completely and utterly sold out. But this one is not far behind, just the looks of it. It might be funny, but it mostly just looks terrible.
the commercials do make it look interesting, but like not something I would see in the theater.
Yeah. Did you see that picture Jeff Wells posted of they have this giant head on a car that they're just driving around Los Angeles, so you're just seeing this giant head of Eddie Murphy driving around LA. It looks totally bizarre, but kind of a clever marketing ploy, getting you thinking about it.
Yeah, I did see that. And it's funny because, you know, Wells loses no Wells takes any opportunity to mention how much people now hate Eddie Murphy for leaving the Oscars after he didn't win. Dreamgirls.
Yep.
And that does seem pretty classless. Oh man. And anyway, so I looked it up, and Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't have anything listed as upcoming. Fincher has Benjamin Button.
Yep.
And Rendezvous with Rama, which
that's right.
That's been one of those things that's been, sort of popping around in some form or another.
Oh my God!
Forever.
Are you there, dude? I'm gonna keep talking until I hear you.
La 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 la. I'm still here. Why can't you hear me? Yeah, I guess you can't hear me. All right. Hey, dude.
Hey. Yeah, Rendezvous with Rama, that was, I think I read that in high school science fiction class. I'm pretty sure.
I've read it. It's a weird book. There's almost no resolution. It's like these guys go into this thing, they poke around, you know, they find some stuff, but they find random stuff. It's not like they're solving, you know, at the end of the book, they haven't figured out what this thing is or why it's there. It's just sort of there.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I'll need to hit Wikipedia and read the plot, check out the plot again. But that was my recollection. So you'd have to, you'd really have to shift it a la, the Bourne movies where, they use 5% of the book and make the rest up.
And did you hear that they're at work, they've announced the new Bourne movie, and Greengrass is part of it, although I don't think they've actually signed Matt Damon to it yet. But they've announced that it will be wholly new. There will be no they're not basing it even 5% on any book, which I thought was interesting.
Well, I read the first Bourne book, and I think I either read the second or the third. To me, I'll see it no matter what.
That had
no effect on me.
Yeah, zero. Hopefully it'll be at least freeing. They don't even feel like they need to pay lip service to some anachronistic 1970s plot line. And then hopefully they'll move on, because I've loved those movies, but to a certain extent they've covered an arc in these first three and about him understanding his background and stuff, and now it's time to let's go somewhere else.
Yeah, I agree, and they've said that. Both Damon and Greengrass have said, we're interested in doing another one, but the script's got to be there because we've like you said, they've covered that arc. So.
Yeah. Did you watch the trailer, by the way, for the new Bond movie?
Yeah, I saw it, you know, in like the 2-inch AOL streaming screen.
Yeah, what'd you think of it?
Looked good.
Yeah, it looked awesome. It definitely, you could see even more of the Bourne influence with the, just briefly with a stunt. They hired the stunt coordinator for the last Bourne movie to be like second unit on this. And there's a shot of a motorcycle jumping onto a boat and it follows him on there. And it reminded me exactly, in a good way, of the shot of Jason Bourne jumping into that window with the camera following him.
Well, what I thought was interesting was that, you know, they've got sort of the Mr. White bad guy character from the last film.
Yep.
You know, basically referring to, you know, Vesper by name.
Yeah, they're saying that it was the most amazing thing. I couldn't believe this. It was total news to me. I heard last week that it's literally for the first time in the history of the Bond franchise, it's an absolute unequivocal direct sequel to the last one, and it starts like 2 minutes after the last movie ended.
I had heard that was going to happen, but I had sort of assumed that, like, maybe they would dispense with the, you know, sort of the dangling plot lines quickly and then move on to something new. And by virtue of looking at how they did this, you know, that doesn't appear to be the case. It appears to be much more of, like you said, the whole movie is going to be dealing with that. And
Yeah. That
sort of took me by surprise. Like, oh, I knew it was going to happen right after, but by mentioning the character name, you're really tying the two together.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's like it's just totally new. And it was like, God dang, they're not going to screw this up. They definitely have restarted this franchise in such a truly great way. And I for one, cannot wait. It's like, yay, this looks awesome, and I can't wait. So,
did you, our good friend Jeffrey Wells.
Yep.
I was surfing. I was on his site the other day, and I saw he had done an interview with Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, I was going to download it. I just didn't do it yet.
And I never listen to his interviews, mainly because I don't have the time.
Yep.
I just never have the time for that. But I came across it on Friday, and I was working at home and doing work where I could listen to that without it detracting from my work. So I listened to it, and it was a pretty interesting piece, with Jeff Wells sounding much more normal, and I always kind of picture him as being much gruffer.
Yeah.
But, he, you know, he sounded pretty cool, and he was talking about The Hobbit a lot, and it was funny because, you know, Wells is always talking about how he hates the Lord of the Rings films and what Peter Jackson, you know, he just hates that kind of film, and he's been kind of down on
The Hobbit.
And
he also very pointedly talked about how De Toro, this is like the height of his creative powers, and he's about to, like, at the height of it, head off to New Zealand for 4 years and make, like, these big studio films where he won't be able to flex his creative powers. So he was sort of, like, bemoaning that, the loss to movies.
Yeah, so they really didn't talk about that at all, which I thought would have been much more interesting.
Yeah.
But they did talk a bit about how he's going to do the first year of pre-production in L.A. and just fly to New Zealand every couple of weeks instead of moving there.
In pre-production.
But, you know, sort of. Yeah, that's what I said, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Talking about how, you know, the first film is going to be much more out there because they're doing The Hobbit in two films.
Yep.
And the second film is going to be much more ramping up to the look and feel of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which I thought was pretty interesting in terms of, you know, kind of what Lucas did in the prequels, how they had a very distinct visual identity. And then towards, you know, the last 15, 20 minutes of the third film, they start introducing design cues that would mesh into the first Star Wars film. And I remember actually really liking that. And, you know, he was talking about how the crowds, when they were doing screenings for Revenge of the Sith, the third prequel, and people would suddenly just start cheering. And Lucas was like, I couldn't figure out why they were cheering. And then I realized it was because we shot this in a hallway set that looked like, you know, the first scenes from Star Wars and that Corellian frigate or whatever it was. And so, you know, sort of purposefully doing that and changing your design. So the fact that he has to change the design, it sounds like he'll have pretty free rein to have his own design sensibilities be the case throughout the first film and the first half of the second film. But which is cool. But then when you think about The Hobbit, there's not a lot that would need his sensibilities, you know?
I know. But that, then again, you know, it's just interesting. He's so visually creative. And looking at some of the stuff for this Hellboy 2 and, of course, Pan's Labyrinth, I mean, it's just so distinct and so incredible. But, you know, to a certain extent, when I think of The Hobbit, I want to see more Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings kind of stuff. So you just wonder if there's going to be a conflict. How much of that is Weta? How much of that is Guillermo del Toro? Because, I mean, he's so talented visually with his own distinct stamp, and you wonder how much of that's going to be allowed to be part of this or not or whatever.
Well, I would assume they would have given him free rein.
I would too, I'd hope.
Or a lot of free rein, because they understand what he brings, and what's the point of bringing him on if you're not going to use what he brings?
I agree. Did you read some of the newer stories about the lawsuit between the Tolkien estate and New Line? And they had, you know, I was looking at the reality, and I don't blame them for being ticked off. And a lot of it's just because their dad signed a dumb deal in the late 60s, but essentially their dad signed away the rights to The Hobbit, or to The Lord of the Rings for basically like $7,500, but plus like 10% of the profits of any movie. But of course, like anybody, he signed it for gross profit points. And then that deal was sold to what's the producer? Saul Zantz, who's the famous producer who produced like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and a whole bunch of other big movies, and he got the rights. And of course, he made that Lord of the Rings cartoon movie, that horrible movie in the 70s, and then he sold the rights to New Line.
I don't know, it seems like there was a lot of affection for that movie. I've never heard it referred to as horrible.
You gotta be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me that you've not heard of it as horrible. It's so poorly animated, you know, that Ralph Bashke rotoscoping animation and I'll find you the first 1,000 references of it being horrible, and then
maybe the stuff I've read, because you know everything I
there is
I
affection
actually,
for it because people remember it, you know,
well,
of the time
and
it was their introduction, but it's never been called anything less than just an awful adaptation.
Well, you say never,
and Ralph Bashke himself says it, because it was originally going to be, you know, stretched. It was like the first part. It just sort of ends. It does, because it was because they were trying to film the whole movie and then they ran out of money. Anyway, so suffice it to say, they're suing them because they're supposed to get 10% of the profits. Well, Lord of the Rings, the three movies worldwide, including DVD sales, made like $7 billion. And how much of the Tolkien's got of that for their 10%, which should be $700 million? They've gotten zero. No money. Because of Hollywood accounting, which will never let the movie ever make a profit. And Peter Jackson, you know, he sued New Line because he didn't think he was getting his profits. Yet Peter Jackson's made like $200 million from that movie. Saul Zantz made like $180 million from those movies, which is the most anybody's ever made from a movie that has had nothing to do with the production. And the Tolkien estate, the people that generated it all, zero, zip. So I don't blame them to a certain extent for being so awful about it, because, you know, this whole Hollywood accounting that movies can never make money just seems ridiculous. It seems awful, you know.
It is undoubtedly ridiculous.
And if they you would just hope, at least for the Hobbit, they would say, okay, you know what, it might help us for this movie to get the family on board, so let's cut them into the profits. Even though we didn't have it, let's cut them in so they can participate in our making of stuff, even though we don't have to do it. Let's just do it and throw them a bone and end this misery because their dad signed a dumb deal, even though nobody realized it at the time. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you know, and at the time, you know, it's funny because I was thinking, well, God, I guess everybody at the time was making these dumb deals, but I watched on Hulu.com The Longest Day. I'd never seen it before. It's this big production in the mid 60s about D-Day, the D-Day invasion, everything. And Richard Zanuck paid like $250,000 for the rights to the book in the early 60s. Thinking, damn, they were giving away $250,000 in the early 60s, yet J.R.R. Tolkien sold the rights to his book for $7,500 and no profit. So, I mean, he just clearly got a bum deal. So, anyway, I digress.
No, that's relevant to our discussions. Oh, got it. Anyway, it was an interesting Del Toro interview.
Yeah.
Going back to the Wells thing, it was pretty cool to hear. God, what was that? And then I had something else I was going to bring up. Nope, maybe
well,
not.
despite some of the worst reviews ever, Hancock made $110 million this first week.
No kidding.
Yeah, $107 million.
Yeah. Fortunately, my wife was, when I told her it was getting really bad reviews, she didn't need to see it in the theater anymore, so that was good.
Yeah. I keep seeing different production shots of him holding up that damn BMW 2002. Making me want to see this movie, but yeah, yeah, but it did well. It just shows that the power of Will Smith is undiminished.
God, that was completely apropos of nothing. I got my new Car and Driver last night.
Yeah.
And Car and Driver, they're always talking about how people must hate them because, you know, they're always giving BMWs good reviews, especially the 3 Series.
Yep.
That's saying, the spiritual heir. You guys are on BMW's payroll.
Yeah.
And so apparently the Car and Driver offices just moved, and they printed a letter yesterday, or they printed a letter that I read yesterday that was saying, well, since you used to be on like 2002 Hogback Road and now you're moving somewhere else, you clearly are no longer on the BMW payroll because of the BMW 2002.
Yeah.
And there was some other funny stuff in there, and it was written by like the North American communications director for, oh, crap. Hello? Hey, dude.
Sorry. Go ahead and restart your BMW. They're not on the payroll.
It's not even that amusing.
It sounded amusing. You were going somewhere.
They were just commenting that since their old address was 2002 Hogback Road, and now that they're moving, they don't have that homage to BMW in their address anymore.
Yep.
And it would be a shame. And it was written by the, you know, like the North American Communications Director of BMW, which I thought was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Anyway,
did you see the New York Times reviewed the Koenigsegg CCX yesterday?
No.
It was a funny review because, you know, for whatever reason, New York Times has gotten into reviewing supercars lately. But they had a great quote. I'm going to open it up here at the very end. They're talking about this movie and they said, you know, some sports cars like the Corvette Z6 have been described as a ticket waiting to happen. The Koenigsegg is like Guantanamo Bay waiting to happen. So it's pretty funny. And they also reviewed previously that Shelby... the hell's the name of that car? The one that went out in Richland, Washington, and drove 257 miles an hour. The new fastest car ever. Anyway, so it's funny the New York Times has suddenly decided at the height of the gas crisis to start heavily reviewing supercars.
Well, I don't think that I'd have to check. I think right now the fastest. God, it might be like an Ascari or a Noble.
Well, this one just set the record, literally like a month ago.
And you mean like a Salt Flats thing?
Yeah,
like
but out in, of all places, Richland, Washington, and they currently are the current Guinness Book of World Record holder. It went 257 miles an hour. Let me go to ShelbySupercars.com because that's where I saw it. It's some hand built thing, but they're. Yeah, the world's fastest.
Oh, yeah, I see it. The Ultimate Aero. Okay, I do kind of remember that now.
World's fastest production car. So, and it's surprisingly not that expensive, considering anything else. But it's clearly just a cruddy, supercar, which you're going to spend a lot of money. Yeah, 1,100 horsepower. If you, 1,200 horsepower if you drive it on ethanol. Which it seems crazy.
Well, my guess is that this probably would not last as long as a Veyron.
No. No, it beat the Veyron, but I agree. It's going to, yeah, although I thought it was funny. I mean, when James May drove that Veyron down there in that German test track, I mean, the things he was pointing out there would have never occurred to me before, where he was talking about how, you know, you get up to like 100 or like 200 miles an hour and it takes this much power to go, but to go the final 40 miles an hour, it takes like more and more horsepower than the first 200 miles an hour just because of the wind resistance. And then the other thing he was talking about was the amount of gas mileage it was getting. It was getting like less than a mile a gallon. And then, and he's also saying how the tires are at that speed would not last like 10 minutes. You know, right. Just all the stuff he was pointing out, stuff that never occurred to me. And also, of course, he's on this incredible test track, and it took everything of that test track to be able to get up to that speed. And so the fact is whoever has that car, there's virtually no chance they could ever get it up to that speed ever. No chance whatsoever, which I found interesting.
Well, I think a good number of those end up going to the Middle East, like Sultans and whatnot. So if they have like Bonneville salt flat conditions out there,
apparently they don't, though. You know, they have roads that are notoriously messed up, but they drive them in circles and drift with them and stuff.
Whatever.
Can you imagine drifting with a Veyron?
Still playing Grand Theft Auto 4.
Yep.
I just told you what I was before we started going. I think I'm around 60% done, according to that.
Yep.
But it looks like I'm, you know, ramping towards finishing the main mission.
Cool.
That's what I'm driving to. I'm like, okay, I'm ready to finish this guy. But it's clear if I was in no hurry, I could spend a ton of time in this game. They built in a lot of experience, which we were talking about last week. But it's just, I've got, you know, if I had nothing else, that would be great. But I have other stuff to do. You still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. But I tell you, one thing that really helps is, I wouldn't call it cheating necessarily, but looking up some of the missions on the net.
Yep.
And saying, okay, and like, it really helps to have a rocket, you know, an RPG for this one. So I'm like, okay, I'll go buy one. I look at that as a time-saving maneuver.
Well, that was my problem. I would just buy everything all the time, and that's how I screwed myself, because I noticed you got the $500 million earn or whatever.
Yeah, I got that yesterday.
Because I clearly earned that and then some, but I would just kind of keep going back and buying more rocket launchers, rockets, at like $5,000 a piece, because I figured every mission could benefit from the rocket launcher. And I would just use them liberally. So now if I want to get that achievement, I'm going to have to break a bunch of cash registers and hopefully get lucky.
Well, and it's funny because I got the achievement, so I don't need to keep that much money going. And yet, because I'm such a cheap ass in real life,
yep,
I have a hard problem even spending fake money.
That's funny. That is funny. I clearly have no problem with it.
I don't think I'll be able to get it done today, but I would guess within the next couple of weeks I can drive through.
Cool.
I can punch through to the end. But yeah, it's been an impressive... there's an impressive amount of depth in there. And then hopefully, I still have your Ghost Recon 2, and a friend is supposed to be sending me in the mail his Lego Indy.
Yeah.
And then in September, the new Force Unleashed Star Wars game.
What's that about?
Well, that's just the latest Star Wars game.
There's different kinds. There's first-person shooter ones.
You're the Anakin apprentice.
Oh.
Between the trilogies. Hmm. It looks pretty interesting. They made a big deal about the physics engine and how they're using like three different engines. There's like a separate physics engine, and then there's a separate, you know, game engine, and then there's a whole separate lighting engine. I can't remember the specifics, but they made a big deal about the fact that they married these three engines. And
yep.
There's some gameplay videos out a couple of months ago, and it does look pretty interesting, and I will probably get it. I don't think, kind of, there was something else that was out I may get Too Human because I think I can get that from my friend at the MS store.
Too Human, what's that?
It's sort of a Norse. I don't want to call it Mass Effect type game. I don't know if it's an RPG like that or not.
Yep.
But it's sort of a weird combination of action and RPG that's sort of been famously delayed on the Xbox forever. It looks interesting. I'm not sure if it's worth 25 of my hard-earned dollars through the MS store. And there was one other that recently came out that I was... Ninja Gaiden 2, that was it. I downloaded the demo for that, and I played it a little bit. And it seemed interesting, but, you know, the first one was famously very, very difficult. Did you ever play it?
No, never. No interest whatsoever. Maybe the name threw me off.
I think I... Because John used to subscribe to the magazine, so he'd get the demo discs, and I think I played the demo off of one of his discs. Anyway, visually beautiful game, but it's one of those where you're like, well, it's a game, and I would play it, but I don't have a lot of interest. If I was going to pay full price and $60, I'm sure I wouldn't pay for it. So it's like, is it worth the $25 and the trouble to have my friend get it for me? I don't know.
They make video games out of movies, and they'd like Scarface and Godfather, these big sprawling ones. Were you aware that they made a video game for Fight Club? And it was released
not.
On the Xbox.
I was not aware.
Oh my
of that.
God! For whatever reason, I was searching the web last night. I decided to watch Goodfellas again, and I saw this one actor, and I was looking, wonder what he starred in, and then I saw Fight Club, and I go 2004, and then I see the dreaded words VG behind it, and meaning video game, and it just looks awful. And then, oh man, I'm looking for the review, because there was some, let me find the comments, because somebody had the somebody had this great review. Most of them are just like the worst game in history, misses the point, it's awful. And then one person added, let me see if I can find it. Oh man, I'm not seeing it either. But anyway, it ended with, this is Jack's utter disappointment. In other words,
that was
the review. But it was, they had a little link to a video from the game, and it just looked terrible. But they got Meatloaf to do his voice in the movie, and then a bunch of other people you haven't even heard of. And then Meatloaf in the video, you can see he's got his big man, you know, boobs, and it's just, you know, it just looks funny. But anyway.
So that's it for video games. And this Friday, iPhone 3G comes out.
Yeah, I wasn't going to get it, no longer. I think I told you I went to the Apple store last week and picked one up for the first time. I was like stunned. I had no idea how high quality that screen was and how easy to use it was. I mean, I went to my website, my little bot or mine off website, which is a pretty dense website and a big site. And I was stunned even without reducing the size of the screen or zooming in. I could read the whole thing. It was such high quality. It was just incredible. I guess I've been used to my Pocket PC, which at the time when it came out, the screen was great, but it cannot remotely hold a candle to the iPhone. Remotely. It is so incredible. You know, and that's the old one. Who knows if the new one's better in any way, shape, or form, but.
No, the new one uses the exact same
screen. I know. It's just unbelievable how high a quality that thing is.
What's funny to me is, how many similar phones are being released that do a lot of the same things, like HTC and
the Instinct
and whatnot, that you see them on Engadget. But it's funny. It's like it doesn't matter. If something puts all these items together, like, better than an iPhone, no one seems to care.
Yeah.
Because the software is just not there. And the interface just doesn't work quite the same. And it's just, like, you can't get any traction. It's like the original iPod. Everyone made a bunch of different iPod or MP3 players, and nobody cared. It's like creative may make a bunch of great ones, and people may have heard of the Zen.
Yeah.
But you know, less than 5% or something like that. It's just it didn't matter.
Yeah.
It was. It's just stunning how good a job Apple does at you know, entering a marketplace like that and then just dominating
in every way, shape, or form.
Even if someone releases a superior product on the technical merits, it just gets no traction whatsoever.
Yeah, it's amazing to think literally 1 year and 1 month ago, Apple did not have a phone. And and now, whatever market there is, they are the dominant force. Even if they are not selling as many as maybe other ones, they are the standard bearer in every possible way. Every way. There's nobody even – everything is done in comparison to their phone, a market that they were not even in a year and a month ago. Unbelievable.
Well, my – you know, it comes out on Friday, so my goal is to get one on Friday. The only thing that will keep me from doing that, because apparently, unlike last time when you could just buy it and activate it at home,
yeah,
you need to activate it in the store. And it's unclear how long that's going to take, but it can take up to half an hour.
Yeah.
Because MacBreak Weekly was making fun of the AT&T video that they had for how to buy an iPhone.
Yeah.
So it can take up, and if... You know, who knows what the pent-up demand and the line situation is going to be.
You know, I got to think it's going to be awful. My mom and I went to the Apple store like a week ago on a Thursday at like 2. So we go in there. There has to be 25 customers wandering through this store at Linwood. And, by the way, a ton of staff. There was nobody waiting around. Everybody was being helped. But I'm looking here going, dang, this place is packed to the gills, and it's like on an afternoon on a Thursday. I couldn't believe how popular it was. I gotta think that. Nope, you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. So I gotta think that it's gonna be popular and crazy and, you know, just crazy.
Well, I was gonna say that school is out, so that may have contributed to the.
Could be, but these were definitely all adults. It was not, you know, but, you know, it could have been college kids. Did you hear that secretly somebody, one of the many rumors, they're talking about making a corporate version of the iPhone that has a flip-out keyboard? Because they're saying that, you know, the big market that they want to penetrate, which they've made great steps towards, is this corporate market. And these places are so committed to having keyboards like a BlackBerry, that they're thinking we might just develop a version that even though we love this thing, I could hardly imagine Steve Jobs doing that. But if that's the big holdup for getting in these markets that people have to have a keyboard, you know, maybe it'll be like that HTC and it has like a flip out keyboard. But, you know, I honestly don't see it happening, but it would be interesting if it did.
I would think not, but what was I going to say? Oh, just, you know, so if there's, well, the first day, the first iPhone, there were lines and whatnot, but if you went in, you know, in the afternoon, 2 or 3 o'clock,
yep.
You know, it sounded like the lines had gone down by then. You could just waltz right in and buy one.
Yeah, all those people that were in line that thought there was some kind of scarcity and had their game plans for selling them on eBay, and it's like, yeah, why would I buy it on eBay when they have plenty?
So in this case, you know, if there's a line, will the fact that it takes forever to activate it, you know, how bad will that screw things up? That's the big X factor.
Yeah.
So and we'll see. I have to poke on the net and find some AT&T stores. So hopefully I'll get it Friday. The only thing that will keep me from getting it Friday is if the activation, you know, is just taking so long that by the time I get off work, it's just not feasible, but we'll see.
Did you see the news story that there's some study that says 12,000 laptops a week are lost at airports or left at airports?
Meaning, I saw the headline.
Meaning at the security counters. And specifically, like LAX alone, 1,200 laptops a week. I mean, that's just unbelievable. That's like every 5 minutes somebody is leaving a laptop. And they're pointing out that fully like 70% of them are never reclaimed. And you know what they do? They destroy them. And you got to think that, oh man, they could put some law or something into place to say, listen, let's create a service that will absolutely fundamentally buzz out whatever private data is on here and reclaim them. But the fact that they're destroying upwards of, let's see, 5 million or maybe 4 million laptops a year just seems shameful, you know? Unbelievable. Yeah, just unbelievable.
Yeah, I agree.
I could never imagine forgetting my laptop, or at least not running back and getting the thing or reclaiming it. It just stunned me, that number. Unbelievable.
Well, you and I, well, you have a desktop too. Like, my laptop is it. I have the laptop, and that is all.
I do have a desktop, but you're right. This thing is on 95% of the time. It is within 5 feet of me almost all the day. And you know what? I have to send this damn thing in to HP to replace this key that broke. And it's amazing how much I have to go through, and just psychologically, to know I'm going to be without this laptop, without it for a week. I have to, like, transfer all my stuff onto my other thing. I have to rejigger my life. So, and I'm still, they sent me the box to ship it to them 3 weeks ago, and I still haven't brought myself to ship the thing to them. You know, it's amazing. So I could not imagine ever leaving it, but, you know, I guess with others, comes and comes.
Yeah, I don't know. Weird. I should probably go ahead and wrap up.
Sure.
You guys rock at mustardmayonnaise.com is how you reach us. My name is Matt.
I am Richard.
And thank you for listening.